Welcome to the Aaron Werner podcast on iCode Media. I'm joined today by my good friend, mentor, and fellow San Diegan and rock star, right, Dr. Mick Kling. Mick, you had a big gig over the weekend. How did that go?
I did. It went great. We've had two gigs rain out so far this year, believe it or not, in San Diego. So it was nice to actually see the sun shining. I know everybody thinks that San Diego is always sunny, but it's not. So we get rain too.
We do. Now, is getting rained out on a gig good luck, like getting rain on your wedding day? Or is it?
No, it's bad luck because that means I don't make $20 or whatever I'm getting paid for the gig.
Yeah, but the beer's free, right?
Usually.
Yeah, very nice. So excited to have you join today. I want to talk about a conversation or a topic that's near and dear to both our hearts, and that is practice transitions. And I want to talk about practice transitions and not just practice buying or practice selling, because it's important to understand, I believe, the concept from both sides of that perspective. And if I'm doing my math right, you have been involved in one way or another with well over 100 practice transitions. Is that right?
Yeah. I would say well over 100. And in some cases, I'm highly involved in the conversation between the buyer and seller, if we're working with two vision source practices. Sometimes I'm just involved peripherally to make introductions to attorneys or bankers, or just answering transition questions. You know, a lot of people that buy and sell understandably don't understand the process. And so a lot of what I do is just provide education and support about how to get things done, how to get from point A to point B. Just because none of us were really ever trained how to do that.
No, we were not. And you brought up VisionSource. So can you elaborate a little bit about your role within VisionSource, just so everybody knows who you are? And then we'll jump into the misconceptions and things that you've seen on this journey.
Yeah, sure. So my title at VisionSource is Practice Transition Advisor. We have about 3,000 practices in our network, all independently owned. And at any given moment, let's say 1% of our membership is transitioning ownership. So these can be senior doctors that are ready to transition out of ownership. We have a lot of very entrepreneurial young members that are buying second, third, fourth locations. So I help support them through that transition. The other thing that we have a lot of is members that really feel that it's important to transfer their legacy onto the next generation. And so they're selling to their associate doctors. And so these are docs that have been in the practice for many years, understand the culture, understand how the practice operates from a sort of a day-to-day standpoint, but just haven't had any ownership. And so I assist them through that process of taking over the leadership role and ownership of the practice.
Yeah, which isn't always as easy as I think that we think it would be on the onset. At least it wasn't for me, even when I bought Dad's practice.
Right? Well, listen, you know, talking about buying Dad's practice opens up a whole other can of worms, which is a family transfer. So I at any given moment, I'm involved in at least a couple of those. And I see two things happen. One, you know, mom and dad, if they're selling the business, they just want their children, whoever's going to buy it, to be passed on something that they can continue into perpetuity. And they're not very concerned about the price of the practice. Then on the other hand, I see a lot where the mom and dad are like, listen, I'm getting every dime out of this practice I can because this is my retirement. And so those could actually be somewhat contentious conversations. So family adds another layer of stickiness to the conversation.
Oh, absolutely. When I went into buying Dad's, I made sure that the number one thing that we talked about was making sure that we could all still sit together at Thanksgiving and Christmas, and family came first and involved my siblings. I'm sure that everybody, you know, had their opinion on what should happen, but at the end of the day, the goal was, to transfer the legacy, but then also make sure that we're all family and everybody walked away happy.
And you know, I tell these family transfers, I tell them the exact same thing I tell every other transition I'm involved with, which is for the seller, we want to make sure we give them every dollar of value for this practice that they deserve, but we also can't set the buyer up to fail. And that's the same in a family transfer, in my opinion. I don't think there's any reason why parents need to feel like they are expected to be able to pass something on without getting the value out of the business. They've worked hard to get to where they are. And I think that they deserve, just like any other seller, they deserve to have the most value they can out of the business. So some parents don't worry that much about it. But boy, others sure want to make sure they get their take.
Oh, absolutely. No, it's fun. So that's a great jumping off point into just some misconceptions or some wrong preconceived notions, things that you've come across, you've heard. We've only got 45 minutes or so on this discussion, so we won't be able to dive into everything. But I'm curious, what are some of the big misconceptions that you hear either from the buyer or the seller side, just within that transition strategy?
Yeah, I would say that the number one call that I get from a member that is selling is they call and ask, what's my practice worth? That seems to be the number one question. And it's sort of like our patients in our office is what they call the office and they don't know what else to ask except for how much is an eye exam, right? So that's the number one question. And my stock answer is always, it's worth what somebody is willing to pay and what you're willing to accept. It's not worth a dime more or a dime less than that. If you have a practice for sale in Oklahoma and I'm in San Diego, your practice is not worth very much to me because it would be a long commute, right? So, yeah. But if you're a buyer and you just want to be in Oklahoma, that's where you've always dreamed your practice was going to be, then it's obviously worth a lot more. So there's a lot of intangibles in the valuation side of the conversation. As far as misconceptions, I would say that one of the things that I see very commonly happen is that a seller will get a practice appraisal done. They'll hire a broker or a practice appraiser, somebody who's skilled and experienced in valuing businesses, and they will they'll pay for that service. And they will get a report back, which most of the appraisers put together really nice reports. And then they get anchored to the number that the appraiser gives them. And they've paid money for that number. And I think inherently there may be a little bias toward giving the seller a good number because they're charging that seller for the number. The problem is when you get anchored to a number, then it's really hard to listen if for some reason that number isn't going to work in the deal. And sometimes it comes at the cost of losing the deal. So the misconception I think would be that just because an appraiser said your practice is worth X, it doesn't necessarily mean that's what it's going to sell for, because there's so many other variables and so many other considerations to take in to consider. So just as a seller, just always encourage them, just be open-minded and keep your eye on what the ultimate goal is, which is transitioning ownership. It's not a game of winners and losers. It's about getting a deal done. And so just try not to get anchored.
Yeah. Well, that is true for selling and buying anything, whether it's a house or, the last bike I just sold on Craigslist. In fact, two of them, one I thought was, I put up what I thought they were worth. One sold for significantly less because I didn't get any bites. The other actually sold higher because I had too many people jumping on, and others were willing to offer above for cash. So,
yeah, and that's a great point too, because optometry practices are unique in that we don't typically have multiple buyers that are bidding on the practice. And so when you do get into a situation where you have multiple people that are interested, and it does happen. I was just working with a practice not too long ago that had two really good potential buyers, and then they got into a little bit of a bidding war. So it does happen sometimes. It is not that common. Usually one seller has found one buyer. And honestly, in this market, if you're a seller, you should feel fortunate to find a buyer because there's so many practices for sale and so few buyers. I think that you just have to remember that you're, if you turn this deal down, it may be a while before you get another opportunity for another deal.
Yep. That makes sense. Now, I remember in school, we had a rule of thumb as to how much your practice was worth. So two questions. The first is that rule of thumb still a viable rule of thumb, or was it just oversimplifying a fairly complex process? And then my second question is, when I'm looking at that deal as either from a buyer or a seller, what considerations come into play as to the value of the practice, you know, from a big level?
So, there has been in our industry for many years that practices are worth about 65% of revenue. And I still get sellers who say, when I ask them, well, what do you think your practice is worth? They always sort of stammer for a minute and say, well, I remember reading somewhere that it's worth about 65% of revenue. I don't know who started that. But the problem with that metric is that you can have two $1 million revenue generating practices, and one of them can be just like really well managed and very profitable. Let's say it's got a 35% net, and it's spinning off $350,000 to the owner. And then you could have another $1 million practice that's very poorly managed. Costs of goods are too high. Staff costs are too high. They got into a bad lease, and it could be earning, you know, $150,000. And, you know, it would be very hard to say those practices are both worth $650,000. Right. So that's where that metric really falls apart, because it doesn't take into consideration the expense structure. And that's, at the end of the day, it's the cash flow that's available to service the debt that really determines what a practice is worth. So ask me the second question again.
Well, you jumped into it, right? At the end of the day, it's what factors go into the valuation of the practice. So cash flow, right? Sounds like is the single most largest factor that plays a role.
Yeah, and in fact, one of the things that I've learned is that many times practices will ultimately sell for what a borrower is able to get from a lender. So regardless of an appraisal or regardless of the 65% of revenue number, many times practices sell for just what the buyer can get from the bank. And so it's almost like if you're buying a house and you go to the bank and the bank approves you for a certain amount of money, you could pay more for it, but you'd have to come out of pocket to do it. Well, there's a reason why the bank would only lend you a certain amount, because they looked at your personal expenditures and they're saying that this is all you can afford. And so that's what the bank does with practices as well. They look at the cash flow of the practice, and they look at what's called the global cash flow, which is the cash flow of the individual borrower. And they lump that all together to determine what is available to repay the debt, because the bank simply cares about getting their money back. And so they're going to crunch the numbers and they're going to do the math. So if you're a buyer and you have a really big lifestyle, and you've got three Tesla payments and a big fat mortgage and, you know, a lot of credit card debt, a lot of student loan debt, that's going to make it harder for you to get a loan to buy a practice as compared to somebody who's maybe has a little bit more of a frugal lifestyle and hasn't overextended on the personal side. And so one of the things I tell sellers, unfortunately, the value of your practice is somehow indirectly related to the credit worthiness of the borrower. So you could have two borrowers. One may be more credit worthy than the other. And so for that borrower, your practice may be worth a little bit more. And to the other one that's a little bit more overextended, your practice may be worth less. That's not something that we like to hear, because we like to think of our business as a standalone entity that has value. Yep. But at the end of the day, again, it comes down to what a borrower is willing to and able to pay for the practice. Yep.
The Myopia Collective. CooperVision and the AOA have partnered in a groundbreaking initiative to change the way optometrists in the U.S. treat children with myopia. The purpose of the Myopia Collective is to rally the profession of optometry and its allies to interrupt the status quo and elevate the new standard of care for children with myopia. Every individual is encouraged to become a member of the collective. By joining, you commit to taking action to help slow the progression of myopia in children. You'll receive updates and information about the collective and its work in the fight against myopia, gain access to educational opportunities and resources offered by the collective, and hear from change agents, the ambassador optometrists selected to serve as advocates for community and policy change that facilitates the mission of the collective. Scan the QR code or click on the link in the show notes to join the collective today.
In the past, our focus revolved around prescribing MacuHealth or MacuHealth Plus to patients at risk of macular degeneration, while also recommending it to collegiate and professional athletes for enhanced contrast sensitivity in sports performance. However, this year's introduction of the Life Meter has been a game changer. The Life Meter revealed a concerning truth. Many of my patients have alarmingly low skin carotenoid levels, indicating potential deficiencies in essential body tissues like the retina and brain. Supported by over 30 peer-reviewed publications, Life Meter's accuracy, consistency, and effectiveness has been demonstrated across 2,000 subjects with diverse backgrounds. With this newfound insight, I can now have meaningful conversations about carotenoid levels with all of my patients, even those who may seem outwardly healthy. To learn more about this empowering technology, feel free to contact your MacuHealth representative or click on the link in the show notes. Together, let's optimize patient care and elevate their well-being.
That's a really good point. Although those Tesla payments were because my tax preparer told me that if I bought another car, I could save money on my taxes.
Yeah, yes, yes. I just wrote an article about that, by the way. Yeah.
It drives me nuts. In fact, side tangent, that's my number one question to when I'm looking for a CPA is, what's your opinion on me paying taxes? And in my world, the right answer is I want you to pay as much as possible, but just appropriately, because that means you made a lot more money, right?
Well, you know, one of the books that you and I both really enjoy is Greg Crabtree's book. Drawing a blank on the name, Big Profits. You probably have it right there. Yes, that orange one right there. Simple Numbers Made Big Profits. So great book. If anybody really wants to get a really much better handle on business finances, that's a great book to read. But I don't know if you remember this section in there, but he said the number one best metric of determining practice success is how much you paid in taxes.
Yep.
He said, companies that don't make money don't pay taxes.
Yeah.
And so if you're not paying taxes, that's a great tax strategy, but it also means you're not making any money. So I just, that always stuck with me.
Yeah. No, I loved that. And then jumping from that over to your Profit First book, you know, I'm happy to pay taxes because I've got a bank account with 4% interest right now with all that money sitting in there. So.
Yeah, you're planning, so you're not getting surprised. I think it's important to just remember that we pay our CPAs to file our returns, and I wrote this in that little article I just did. We pay our CPAs to file our tax returns and to make sure we don't pay taxes or don't overpay on taxes, right? But so they're inherently hardwired to have us not show profit because that's their job, right? The problem is they may make recommendations to us that achieve that goal, but also can create future problems. And an example I gave is this, what you were alluding to, which is to go out and buy another car, which is great to get the tax deduction now, but you're locking yourself into another car payment. And so that can actually impact your cash flow negatively. So what does this have to do with practice transitions and acquisitions? It's all related. Because if you do that, you try to follow your CPA's tax strategy, now you just put yourself into this position where you maybe have a hard time getting a loan to buy a practice.
Yep. Well, and what strikes me as interesting, and so I've bought two practices, haven't sold any, but I've peripherally helped quite a few colleagues and walked them through. And what has struck me interesting is that the idea of buying a practice or selling a practice, in my mind, is very similar to buying and selling a home, but the not everybody thinks that same way. I've a couple of my friends, you know, went out and bought a brand new BMW, and then were surprised when the bank turned them down for the practice loan. Right, and to your point, it's all cash flow. It's what you have. It's your lifestyle. It's you know what you're available with, what you have available to service that debt. if you want the BMW, just wait until you're done if you can afford it.
Right.
Fill it with the big rocks first.
Yeah, you know, buying a practice is very similar to buying a house, because for sellers, you obviously want to put your best foot forward. You want to spruce it up. You know, all those stains on the carpet, you want to do something about those. If you still have mauve walls and, you know, forest green paint, you know, it's time that you do something about that, because the buyer, the first thing they're going to do is they're going to walk in, and the first thing they're going to think is, how much money is it going to cost me to get this practice looking and smelling the way that I want it to look and smell? And so sellers often, and we all do this. I mean, we all walk over our the trash that's right in front of us and don't even notice it anymore. And but sellers often get into a place where they stop investing because they're thinking, oh, I'm going to sell. I don't want to spend any money. I attended a little bit of a side note, but I attended a practice transition course put on by the dental industry. And I went because I was just really curious to see how they approach the topic. And it's very, very similar to optometry. They're so parallel. But one thing that the speakers were saying, advising the sellers to do, is whatever you do, don't spend any money before you sell your practice. And that struck me. And I think what they were saying was, don't make big investments in expensive CT machines, because, you know, in dentistry, you know, these things are $100,000 or more. They're like optometry. They have these expensive toys, because it might be the wrong one. It might be one that your buyer doesn't want to get. So I think there's some validity in not spending money on certain equipment if you're not sure. But having the basic equipment to do a good comprehensive eye exam, like ultra wide field retinal imaging, OCTs, all that kind of stuff, is very critical. The cosmetic piece of it is really important, and, you know, you should be maintained for sure. But making an investment in a brand new EHR system, if you're not sure, you might want to wait.
Yeah.
You know, so I think there's some things that just you've got to logically keep up to date. And then there are some things that maybe do deserve to the advice of these guys, which is that you probably should not run out and spend a bunch of money on. Yep. So I think common sense in that area makes a big difference.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and that's good. Just practice management advice to begin with, right? Make sure you've got the equipment stayed up to date. And I'll tell you, the biggest ROI I've ever seen in the office is a can of paint.
Right? Yeah.
You touch up, you cover up the scuffs. It smells like it's new paint. I mean, we repainted the office and it for very little, right? And patients thought we completely remodeled. It baffled me. But
yeah. And people like that. Think about business that you patronize. And I mean, you walk in and things look fresh. It makes you feel, you're not thinking, oh, they just spent a lot of money, so they're going to charge me more. I think a lot of optometrists sometimes think, well, if I spend money to remodel, patients are just going to think I'm raising my fees. But we don't think that as consumers. We enjoy the experience and we're there for a reason. So I don't think there's any downside to doing that. I don't want to forget this. The other thing I would mention is why this is important to make investments in technology and keeping your place up to date, is because one of the things that the bank hates to see is declining revenue.
Yeah.
So what happens, you know, I love whiteboards, and I'm so tempted to turn around and draw on the whiteboard.
I'm impressed you haven't turned around and started.
Yeah, I'm resisting. So what happens is, you know, our practices go up like this over time. Yeah. And then at some point we get tired and maybe a little burned out. We're like, you know, I just kind of slow down a little bit. I think I'll take Fridays off and I'll go fishing. And so you take your foot off the gas a little bit and the practice kind of levels out. And then you start to enjoy that. And then you start thinking about, well, maybe I need to bring in an associate to fill in the work days that I'm not there, because I want to take another day off. I want to take a little longer vacation this year. I've got grandkids. I want to spend time with my grandkids. And then the revenue starts to go down. Mm-hmm. When the buyer takes the banks will usually ask for 3 years of profit and loss statements, because they want to see what the revenue is doing. Is the practice growing or is it declining? And if it's declining, they're going to be looking for a good explanation. They're going to want to know, what is going on? Why is this practice going downhill? You're buying a business that's going downhill, is what they're going to say to the buyer. And that's a really difficult position for the seller to be in, because they have to have a good reason and really have to convince, and the buyer has to convince the bank that this is why it's happening, but I'm going to be able to turn it around. I'm going to come back in and practice 5 days a week because the seller was only in 4 days a week, or whatever the case may be. So sellers, just make sure if you're listening that you make those investments in the practice, keep the revenue climbing, or at least flat, but keep the revenue climbing if you can. Otherwise, it creates a problem for the buyer to get funding.
Oh, absolutely. And then I think it creates an emotional, a weird emotional relationship. And let's be honest, our practices are our babies, and we don't see the warts. We see the potential. I've seen a lot of sellers try to sell on potential as well. Hey, if you just did X, Y, and Z, this is now $1 million practice. So this is $1.3 million or $1.5 million. But as a buyer, I'm not buying potential, right? Yeah. I'm buying what's there right now. I'm going to put in the sweat equity or the financial capital to make it reach its potential. I'm not going to have you be rewarded for potential that's not there, not yet realized.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point. And I will tell you, I hear that a lot from sellers, and they'll say things like, you know, we've never really been much of a medically oriented practice. And if somebody would just come in here and start seeing Medicare patients, this practice would double in size. And so they try to build the value, to your point, into the potential of the practice. But the bank is not going to look at projections. They're only going to look at historical performance. And so the buyer is also going to be slanted toward only seeing what the historical performance of the practice is. Now, can you kind of see some potential as a buyer and think, oh, you know, I might be willing to pay a little bit of a premium for this practice because I see an opportunity here and I'm willing to take that risk? That's certainly up to the buyer to decide. But the expectation of the seller to just command a higher price because of unmet potential is just really not going to happen.
Yep. Well, I totally agree, which again is why it's important to just stay up to date with what you're doing in practice. You don't have to run full speed ahead, but slowing down doesn't mean ignoring and turning a blind eye.
That's right.
It just means, you know, progressively looking at that 5% year over year growth, right? Staying consistent. And even that, your example of the doc who decided to take Fridays off. Well, if you work 5 days a week and now you work four, you just let go 20% of your business. That's not one day a week. That's 20%, which is significant.
Yeah. Yeah. Think about $1 million practice who's now an $800,000 practice.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a significant decline in production and will have a significant impact, especially if your rent didn't go down and you didn't lay off any of your employees. Your cost of goods are true variable expenses, so those will go down a little bit. But your people costs, your occupancy costs, your costs for insurance and marketing and all those other things are fixed. And so as that revenue goes down, your profitability and your cash flow goes down as well. So that definitely has a negative impact.
Especially for a buyer. And I think where some of the misconception, or at least I've seen it, and it's not malintended, but a seller tends not to have too much debt, certainly very little personal debt if they've managed their finances. They don't have student loans. Most of the time their house is close to being paid off, right? Their car is probably paid off. And so all the profits are straight profits. If you were to transition that, let's say they're making, you know, let's say they're taking home $200,000. Well, that $200,000 to the seller is a lot more than the $200,000 to a potential buyer who has to pay student loans, who's starting a family, looking to buy a house, has to pay the note on the practice they just bought. And so net cash flow for each is significantly different. And I think sometimes that's not understood on both sides.
Yeah, yeah. And that's precisely why the bank does what they do, because they want to get their head around what's going to be the true burden to the buyer, because the seller can say, hey, look at my profit and loss statement. Look how much money I made. Look how great you're going to do. Well, at the end of the day, it may not be as great of an opportunity for the buyer until you plug in all those variables that are unique to their situation. So that's a great point.
Yep. Speaking of sellers and buyers, I've seen a lot of practices where the seller has a predetermined notion in their head for how long they're going to stay within the practice. Right. And I think there's lots of different ways to skin this cat. But what have you found is a kind of reasonable expectation or mindset, both from the buyer and the seller's situation when approaching this?
Yeah, there's an author named John Warlow, and he wrote a book. He's written several books, but one of the books I like is called Built to Sell. And he talks about pushes and pulls. And pushes and pulls are pushes are things that are pushing a seller out of ownership. So it might be operational frustration, staff challenges, you know, just the headaches of running the business. And then pulls are all the personal things like, you know, I want to spend time with my grandkids. I want to go fishing. I want to go traveling. And one of the things that he talks about is that when you haven't, as a seller, when you haven't really thought through your pushes and pulls, you can find yourself on the other side in a very unhappy position. And he's got data that suggests a very large percentage, up to 50% of people that sell their businesses actually regret it. And, you know, the idea is that because sellers haven't really thought about what's on the other side. So I've learned when a seller contacts me, one of the first things before we start talking about the money and the price of the practice and all that kind of stuff, we talk about what are you going to do on the other side? Like, have you thought about what's on the other side? And I will say most of the practices that I work with, they're ready. They're like, okay, here's what we're doing. Here's what I'm going to go fishing and I'm going to go travel to Europe and all that kind of stuff. But every now and then I'll encounter somebody that they kind of pause for a minute and I can sort of tell they haven't really thought it through. They'll think, you know, I think I want to work for a while. So I said, okay, this is an $800,000 practice. You're making a couple $100,000 a year. If you want to continue to work a couple of days a week, how is the seller or how's the buyer going to fit into this equation? Like, how are you going to be, how's this practice going to be able to support your 2 days a week, plus whatever the buyer needs to work and to pay all the debt on the practice? And so it sort of leads us to, let's have a serious conversation about what your transition plan would look like. Like, what's your perfect exit strategy? And sometimes, based on the size of the practice, it just doesn't mathematically work for the seller to stay around. And sometimes it can work if it's a bigger practice and we can sort of build that into the equation. But having that conversation sooner rather than later is really, really critical for both parties, because the last thing you want to do is have some expectation created. And then when it comes time to transition, it's just not possible to make that happen.
Well, that makes perfect sense. And then thinking about that $800,000 practice, which really is, and I'm assuming you use this number because that's really kind of the threshold for a solo doc practice, yeah. Right? It's there certainly are practices that do more than that very successfully, but it's tough to do. And so that $800,000 practice is really a one full-time equivalent practice. And that seller doc is taking home 200 grand, right? Just to make the math easy. If they sell and become an associate in the practice, not only is their time decreased, but their revenue from the ownership is decreased as well.
Yeah, and I mean, think about that example that you just gave. So take a $800,000 practice that let's say the practice is netting $200,000, 25%, yep. Which isn't uncommon in practices that size. And let's say the doc wants to work, the seller wants to work 2 or 3 days a week. Well, that might cost, you know, $75,000 to $100,000. So that leaves $100,000 left to service all the debt and pay a wage for the buyer.
Yeah.
And it just makes it very difficult for the math to work. The reason I said 800,000 is that's about the average size of an optometry practice in the US. And one full-time equivalent OD 5 days a week should be able to generate $1 million in revenue. That's 10 eye exams a day, $400 of revenue per exam. If you do the math, it's $1 million practice. But because most of us need at least some administration time, mm-hmm. by the time you build that in, you're probably really delivering about four, maybe 4.5 days of patient care. And I think that's why a lot of practices get stuck in that $800,000 to $900,000 range.
Yeah.
So that makes those transitions difficult when the seller wants to stay on.
Yeah. Well, and if we learned how to bill appropriately and see medical visits appropriately, we could make that significantly higher. So a little shameless plug for Chris Wolf and iCode Education.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are lots of these practices that have a ton of potential. And of course, we talked about not selling on potential, but a ton of potential in the medical side of things. I mean, Aaron, you and I looked at some of Chris's data, and even practices like ours that we think were like highly sophisticated from a medical standpoint were completely missing it and underutilizing all the things that we could be doing on the medical side. So I think the practices that are not leaning into medical care at all are just enormous opportunities for buyers.
Absolutely. I mean, conservatively alone, just looking at only if we build just a level 3 medical visit, you're looking at double digit percentage growth. So look at the size of the practice and, you know, times it by 10%.
Yeah.
And at bare minimum, just by doing the right thing and taking care of patients. So we talked about some other misconceptions that we have. And one thing we haven't hit on, and there's not enough time to hit on it here, but when I've sat through and the class that you and Ali and Dale helped teach, what became apparent to me was that the sales price is the thing we focus on the most, but probably one of the least important things in the entire transaction.
Yeah.
Can you talk to that a little bit?
Yeah. So, you know, culture is such an important part of what you're buying. And one of the things that we tell buyers, we teach buyers, is if you have a vision for a high-end optical boutique practice, you probably shouldn't buy the practice that's doing a free eye exam and 2 pair of glasses for $49.99. I mean, there's a cultural mismatch that's happening there. And so for a buyer and seller to have that, it's almost like dating. To have that cultural match is really important, because the staff members, the employees, the team that's associated with that practice, ideally are going to stay around for at least a little bit. And we should probably talk about what I've seen with staff. You want the staff to stay around for at least a little bit. And it's going to be disruptive enough to come in and have a new owner, but then to come in and to really start changing things very quickly and having a cultural mismatch with the buyer and how the practice has performed historically is really a recipe for disaster. And so for buyers, it's important to really look at that practice and see if that seller aligns with your core values and your practice philosophy and the way you care for patients. All of that is really, really important, because it's going to be tough enough to retain those staff after you become the new owner, if you're the buyer. And you don't want to just make it blatantly impossible for anybody to stick around, patients included. Because if you come in and, you know, Joe's your patient for 20 years and used to getting a free eye exam and 2 pairs of glasses for $50, and now you come in and you want to charge $200 for an eye exam, it just... you're going to alienate a lot of people if you do that.
Yep. We had that experience. I purchased a practice and actually merged his in with ours because he was close enough. Patients got mad. The level of care we were providing was a much more comprehensive level, and not to say the other care was bad. It was just different, right? Mm-hmm. There's Nordstrom's and Target and Walmart and Bloomingdale's and everything for all sorts of different reasons. But patients, one, got mad because we weren't just refracting them and getting them out the door in 10 minutes. Right? Mm-hmm. Our pretest is almost 20 minutes long with all the different diagnostic testing, the screenings that we're doing. So they didn't like that. You know, they'd never paid a contact lens fee. And so they were upset by that. Half the time their copays were waived. So we learned quickly that we weren't going to retain a vast majority of those patients just because our standard operating procedure was so much different than...
Yeah. There's a reason why those patients stayed with that practice, yep. Right? There's a reason why Absolutely. Those patients continue to be loyal because of all the things you mentioned. They don't collect my copays. You know, they don't charge me for anything. So when you change those rules, now all of a sudden it doesn't fit anymore. It doesn't match. This isn't the place that I want to be because you're not doing things the way that you used to do them. Yep. And it doesn't feel right. And that's okay too, because you're going to have experience those patients no matter, even right. if the cultural match is there, you're going to have some of that happening. You just don't want to set yourself up for bigger challenges by having those mismatches with your first practice. Once you buy a second and third and you get better at transitioning cultures, and I think it's a little bit easier because you get a little wiser about how to do it. But certainly on the first one, you don't need more headaches.
No. And I think that one, we knew going into it, it was so different that we had actually built some of that into the structure of the deal. But you brought up staff, and interestingly enough, when I bought my dad's practice, within a year, all but one of them mm-hmm. were gone. And this was a practice that I had grown up in. And I was surprised by that. When I bought the second practice, none of the staff ended up coming over just because culturally there were too many differences. But talk a little bit about that staff culture.
Yeah. So I've purchased or merged in some form or fashion 7 practices. And so have gotten pretty good at sort of observing what happens when you acquire a business and what happens to the staff. And within about 18 months, generally, pretty much everybody's gone from what I see. And that used to bother me. That used to make me feel like we were doing something wrong. But then I sort of realized, like we were talking about the patients, the staff work for that doctor for a reason. They align with their core values. They had some sort of emotional attachment to them. And when that person is gone, leadership changes, culture changes. And so that may no longer be a cultural fit for that person. As the buyer, you want that team to at least be around long enough to keep things moving forward and stable. And so that over time and slowly, and I mean very slowly, you can start bringing in changes to the practice. Where I see new buyers get into trouble is when they come in too hot, too fast, trying to make too many changes too quickly. And it's already hard enough when you start making too many changes, you start alienating the staff. So what I've sort of come to be okay with is that within 18 months, pretty much everybody's going to be gone. But that's okay because it allows the new buyer to bring in their new team that aligns with their core values and that sees them as their boss, not the seller. And so it can be somewhat of a painful transition, but I always tell buyers, give everybody on the team a chance, keep everybody intact, give everybody a chance, because I did have a couple of employees that stayed with me for many, many years, after the transition, but 95% of them were gone. So give them a chance, because sometimes the cultural fit just, it does work. And these could be very valuable key employees for the business.
Absolutely. Well, two thoughts. The first one on staff is I'm amazed at the number of staff that I've had that my colleagues that I highly respect told me they never worked. They weren't good employees. Like they couldn't wait for them to be hired by somebody else. Right. And they come to me and they're some of our best employees. So I think sometimes you just need the right ingredients, the right amount of water, the right kind of sunshine to let somebody shine. And no doubt that I've had employees who didn't do well under me thrive elsewhere. Right. So it's not an errand thing. It's an environment.
Yeah. Even as big of a city as San Diego, you know, we're kind of a small community in the eye doctor world. And so some of these employees do float around a little bit. And some of our best employees over the years have come from other practices where that practice owner says, oh, is so-and-so still working for you? They're the worst employee we ever had. It's like, really? They're fantastic. You know, so it just sort of speaks of how different we are and how unique our business personalities are and our leadership styles and all that really do influence how well somebody that works for the company settles in and fits into the culture.
Yep, absolutely. And then my other thought is something that you shared with me very early on in practice ownership. And you may not even remember telling me this, but you said, I called you complaining about something or panicked, and you laughed and said, Aaron, right now you're going to have good days and bad days. Soon you'll have good weeks and bad weeks, mm-hmm. then months, then quarters, then years. And at some point you're going to have good back, you know, good decades and bad decades.
Yeah.
And it's held true perfectly. So I appreciate you telling me that at the time, but I didn't see the wisdom until later. So,
yeah, well, like most things that I say, I'm just repeating what other people have said to me. And that was said to me by a primary care physician whose office was next door to mine. And I was just brand new into practice. And he said, you know, early on, you're gonna have good months and bad months, but before you know it, you're gonna wake up and you've had good years and bad years. And that's exactly sort of how the arc of my career has gone, and yours as well. And I think it's a good lesson in just remembering you've got the rest of your career to make this practice, if you're a buyer, what you want it to be. And it doesn't have to change overnight. It's gonna take an entire lifetime. And even, you know, as seasoned as you and I are running businesses, it's still hard, and we're still constantly trying to make it better. And it's never going to be as good as we think it could be or should be. But that doesn't mean we don't ever stop striving to, you know, continue to make it better.
Oh, no. Well, that's why I like to refer to it as a game, because games are fun, right? And I'm learning along the way. You know, you mess up and you stumble your toe here and there, right? But the success is way outweigh the failures. And most of the time, the stubbing your toes and stubbing your toe rather and stumbling over your mistakes, or at least my mistakes, have just been learning opportunities.
Absolutely.
A lot more good has come out of that than I thought would be.
Well, I read in a book one time, I'm paraphrasing, I don't remember exactly the quote, but it was something like, there's actually no such thing as success or failure. It's just all experience. And because in everything that you think is a failure, something successful came out of it, even if it was just learning. And everything that you consider success could have been better.
Yep.
So instead of making these binary success and failures, how about we just say everything is an experience and we're always trying to make it better?
I like that. I just wish sometimes I didn't have so many learning experiences.
Yeah, I know. Me too. Me too.
Awesome. Well, speaking of learning experience, I've referenced a couple of times the course that you and Ali Aramshian, our good lawyer friend, and Dale helped teach. Dale's with Bank of America. And tell me a little bit about that course, because it's upcoming on May 20th, 21st. And I want to put an invite out to everybody listening. If you're looking at buying or selling within the next couple of years, right? You got to pay to get there. But the course itself is seating's limited, but registration's free. VisionSource will host you for that course. But dive into a little bit of what goes on during that day.
Yeah, so we have a practice transition course that we do. I do it with Ali Aramshian, as Aaron mentioned. He is a transaction attorney with DM Counsel, and Dale Fisher from Bank of America. And arrival is on the 20th, which is a Monday, 20th of May. Arrive. The course is in Kingwood, Texas, just outside of Houston. It's about 15 minutes from Bush International, so very easy to get to. You arrive on Monday, the evening of the 20th. We'll have a dinner, feed you really well, get you some beer and wine, and just get to know each other. And then the next day on Tuesday, we have an all-day course. It starts at 8 in the morning. We're done promptly at 4. You're back on a plane that evening and home. So it's a very limited amount of time out of your office. No cost to attend. There is a hotel right across the street from our member support center for VisionSource. And it's an easy walk across from the hotel to the classroom setting. And so it's a very easy trip, very easy trip. And we're going to get deep. We're going to spend the whole day. We're going to go through the 7 steps of a practice transition, everything from buyer and seller engagement through due diligence, valuations, all the legal, the contracting, all the lending, you know, pre-closing, day of closing, post-closing. We just really hit it all. So it's a lot of information. If you're a buyer, it's absolutely perfect. If you're just thinking about, like, how do I do this? Or maybe you have a practice that's, on your mind. If you're a seller, tons of information about getting your practice ready, understanding the process, understanding the contracting, all that kind of stuff. So great course, looking forward to it. So do not have to be a VisionSource member. It's open to anyone who would like to attend.
Yeah, absolutely. And why is that, that it's open to anyone who wants to attend and not just VisionSource members?
Well, the selfish reason is because we have tons and tons of practices for sale. So we have, there are many, many VisionSource practices that are on the market or will be on the market soon. And we are looking for private buyers because our mission is to protect and perpetuate private independent optometry. That's our number one goal. We want to see these practices transition to private buyers so that the profession of optometry can be what it needs to be, which is private and independent, at least a large segment of it, because we believe that's the best way to deliver care. Yes, we've got lots of opportunities out there, and we can talk a little bit about that if you come to the course also.
Perfect. And last question, if I'm in an associate relationship, I'm looking at buying the practice I'm in, right? Should I send the seller? Should I go by myself? Should we both come together? What do you think's best?
Yeah, great question. We often have senior doctors who bring their associates to the course. And I will tell you, the best transitions that we work with are the ones where the buyer and the seller are cooperating. And they're coming together, they're learning together, they're understanding the terminology together, they're understanding the process together, and it really makes for a smooth transition. We really just don't have problems with getting attorneys involved and disputes over the valuation and all that kind of stuff when everybody's on the same page, because we make it very clear. Listen, we're not going to tell you what your practice is worth or what you should pay. It's about understanding how to do it. And once you understand how the bank thinks, then everything just sort of falls into place.
Yep, absolutely. I think that's a good point, that you and VisionSource we're not brokers. We're not trying to broker a practice.
No.
We're trying to
help
the practice transition successfully, private practice to private practice.
That's right. We don't buy practices at VisionSource. We don't do valuations. We don't do appraisals. But we will do the math, and we'll help you understand how the math is done and how banks look at the math. And that's very valuable. That makes transitions a lot smoother.
Yep, absolutely. Well, the link is in the show notes for more information and to register. You can click on the link, get all the information. You've got my contact information. So if you have additional questions, you can reach out to me. I'll put you in contact with Mick or answer any questions you have about the course. So Mick, end of a long day after a long day of playing. So I appreciate you giving us about an hour of your time, and certainly for all you do in our community to really help educate and on this very important topic of practice finance, and specifically today, practice transitions.
Thank you, Aaron. It's always a pleasure to get to talk to you.